Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Minding the Climate, How Neuroscience Can Help Solve Our Environmental Crisis by Anne-Christine Duhaime, M.D. Narrated by Susie Elthens. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Preface. It's 8 p.m., and I'm just about to pack up and leave the hospital for the night, when the pager bleats. It's my resident, the junior neurosurgeon in training on for emergency calls, who quickly summarizes an urgent consult from the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit, PICU. It's a 6-year-old. He's on his third liver transplant for a congenital disease, and his blood clotting is way off. His scan shows a 5-centimeter left brain hemorrhage with shift, and he's comatose, with a dilated left pupil and a dropping heart rate. They want us to operate. I ask if the PICU team has corrected his blood clotting, and am told they've given him Factor, and he should be good to go to surgery. I join the resident in the operating room after stopping briefly to meet the family, and explain as gently as possible that, while we'll do our best, this is a grave situation. We may not be able to control the hemorrhage, and their child may not survive the surgery. They nod numbly and cry quietly. After months in the hospital, they can't do much more. In surgery, after we suction out the bulk of the clot, the brain continues to ooze from every surface we've touched. I ask the circulating nurse to call the transplant attending and ask him if there's anything else they can do medically to help the blood to clot. While she holds the phone to my ear, I am told they've given appropriate correctives and the bleeding should be easy to control. I invite them to come look, because it isn't easy to control. In fact, it's impossible to control. After using every hemostatic agent we have in the hospital and every kind of transfusion that might be helpful, and every way to apply gentle pressure to the welling surfaces, we finally recognize that we can only slow, not stop, this hemorrhage. We will have to close up enough to get him back to the PICU and wait. He probably will not survive the night. Other children fare better. Their seizures are localized with magnetoencephalography and suppressed with minimally invasive techniques. Their tumors are resected with help from computerized stereotactic image guidance or laser ablation. Their infections successfully overcome with 5th- and 6th-generation designer antibiotics. They pass in and out of our medical lives, but the traces they leave pale in comparison to those of the children we can't help. Both the successful and the futile treatments require enormous resources in our advanced medical system. New machines, tests, and technologies are added every day, requiring specialized spaces, protocols, and people. We are trained to treat the child before us and not to think of the resources or the energy it takes. If something exists that might help, our job is to think of it and to use it. We must not be distracted by larger issues of who gets what. Meanwhile, on other continents, desperate families risk everything to flee civil wars made worse by a decade of drought. In places where population growth is exploding, the average age citizen is too young to vote, but not too young to suffer when flooding occurs and disease follows, and entire extended families are wiped out. Others live in economic and spiritual poverty, because traditional ways of life and the rituals and society that sustain them are being swept away by physical alteration of a human-changed planet. Closer to home, fires and floods and droughts wreak havoc. Plastic litters everything. Those who already are the most disadvantaged bear the biggest burden, as power plants and polluting industries disproportionately sully their neighborhoods. Parents everywhere worry about pesticides and toxins and rising temperatures. But we are the good guys. Our hospital produces cutting-edge therapies and daily small miracles, along with enormous quantities of carbon dioxide, trash, and poisonous waste that threaten the very futures we've worked to make possible. Mostly, we compartmentalize these contradictions. Our brains allow for this. The American Academy of Pediatrics has stated that climate change is the biggest public health problem we face as a species. This affects all of us and will affect people all around the world. First, the most vulnerable, and children in particular. But while we know this intellectually, and it makes us feel bad, and often helpless, it doesn't typically influence our day-to-day behavior. The conflict between this truly wicked problem, one that is complicated, involving many intersecting and contradictory features, and without a simple solution, and our values and actions in our daily tasks, was the impetus for this book. As most healthcare providers who care for children can attest, it is an extraordinary privilege and is tremendously rewarding to have the opportunity to help patients and their families through medical crises. I chose my career at a time before climate change was clearly recognized, but even then, the problems of exponential population growth and environmental threats seemed to me to be the most consequential ones to tackle. The interdependence of all life forms seems an obvious fact of biology, and we ignore it at our peril. Yet I couldn't escape the hypnotic pull of fascination with the brain, the means and mechanisms of why we are who we are. Like most neurosurgeons, I can remember vividly the first patient, the first case, the moment I was hooked. No other career could allow me to experience the utter amazement of seeing the human brain in action, up close and tangible, with the chance to influence someone's life for the better by quelling a threat to this most awesome invention of nature, the very essence of a person's existence. Just as engineers and artists and cooks perceive the world filtered through what is on their minds most of the time, neurosurgeons are immersed in the brain. How it's designed, how it develops, how it is injured and repaired, how it interacts with the world to create and modify every unique person through all the phases and changes of life. We observe these things in our patients recovering from injuries or surgery, from watching them grow up as we follow them for chronic conditions, and I saw them in my laboratory research on brain recovery and plasticity. From the perspective of many of us in the neuroscience fields, everything, ultimately, is about the brain. How we act, what we choose, what we value, the very history of our species with all its accelerating change reflecting advances in science and technology, it all can be explained through the lens of how our brains work. The brain, like everything else in biology, was designed under the tutelage of evolution. It follows certain principles and has strong tendencies, but is also exquisitely responsive to the culture and circumstances in which it finds itself. We find it rewarding to care for one child at a time and to bring to bear all we are able toward our success, because we are designed that way. Caring for another human being who is right in front of us, expending effort and skill to make that person better, reflects some of the ways we evolved through millennia to function. But when considering larger social issues, it didn't seem surprising to me that climate change, arguably the most important problem for us as a species, was a particularly difficult one for us to address. It's easy to understand its causes through a neural lens. Our extraordinary brains equipped us to adapt, expand, and change the world to our immediate benefit, spurred by a design favoring decision-making based on short-term consequences. But fixing climate change is harder. It's just not the kind of problem our brains evolved to perceive or solve easily. In fact, the choices most needed right now to curb the worst trajectories of climate change often run directly contrary to the way we work, brain-wise. In 1998, environmental writer and advocate Bill McKibben wrote a three-part series for Atlantic Magazine, a special moment in history that was part of a look ahead at the biggest questions of the new millennium. McKibben noted, with some surprise, that changing behavior relative to population seems easier than changing behavior relative to our incessant consumption, which is the root cause of the skyrocketing levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide that invisibly heats our planet. He posited that we just wouldn't be able to live simply enough, soon enough, to reverse this trend.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?